Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 44, which I will call the Gate for the Prince and Rules for the Priest. We are in the series of chapters that deal with Ezekiel's New Covenant Temple. That's what I call it because I think that's what it's a symbol of, a type of. Ezekiel 44 was written about 573, according to Precept Austin. I usually take it a year earlier than that, 572. A year later, I should say, 572. This was about 12 or 13 years after the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 and about 36 or 37 years before the return from Babylon to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel. We begin now in verses 1 through 2 of Ezekiel 44. Then the man brought me back to the outer gate of the sanctuary, the one facing east, and it was shut. The Lord said to me, "This gate is to remain shut. It must not be opened. No one may enter through it. It is to remain shut because the Lord, the God of Israel, has entered through it." Now, who is this man that brought Ezekiel to the outer gate of the sanctuary? This would be probably Jesus. We encountered him first in Ezekiel 40, verse 3. He brought me there to this temple, and I saw a man whose appearance was like bronze. Remember, this is in a vision, not actually. I saw a man whose appearance was like bronze, with a linen cord and a measuring rod in his hand. He was standing by the gate. So this man was probably Jesus because his appearance was like bronze. That's probably like shining, burnished bronze. He had a linen cord and a measuring rod. Those are instruments for construction because he's getting ready to build this temple in Ezekiel's vision. Now, the man brought Ezekiel, Jesus, brought Ezekiel to the outer gate of the sanctuary. Now, what is this outer gate? It's the one facing east, so we know that. But the problem is there were two gates facing east. One on the outer court, which faced east out into the great beyond of the temple complex, and then another eastern gate that led from, as you go east, from the inner court of the priest, out into the outer court. Well, there's a split of opinion on that. Barnes, Gill, Benson, and Poole say that this gate is between the inner court and the outer court. For example, Poole says this is the gate from the inner court where he had been viewing the altar to the outer part of the same court and to the east gate thereof. Others say it was to the temple gate eastward, so Poole acknowledges there's a split of opinion. The pulpit commentary and Kyle and Delitch say that the gate is between the outer court to outside the temple complex completely. Well, in my humble opinion, I think that the option that says that the gate is between the inner court and the outer court is the best option because in verse 3 we see the prince eating just inside the doorway, and such eating would be done in the inner court, not in the outer court. Priest ate their meals in the court of the priest. So we're going to assume that as we go through here. Now, this gate is called the outer gate of the sanctuary. Why is it called the outer gate of the sanctuary? Well, the sanctuary is the temple. The inner court could be considered part of the temple, part of the sanctuary, and so the outer gate of the sanctuary would then be the gate going between the inner court and the outer court, which is what I just assumed. So that's one more piece of evidence, I believe, that helps us isolate where this eastern gate is. Now, this gate was shut, verse 1. Verse 2, the Lord said to me, "This gate is to remain shut." Now, what is the significance of this? This temple is a glorified type, an extended type of the Church of Jesus Christ. So how can the shut gate remind us of the church? Well, here's some options. Option number one, God was never to need to enter his temple again. Because he's in the church, he doesn't need to come in, so the gate is shut. Now, that doesn't sound right to me. In Ezekiel's vision, God has left the temple, and he'll never come in again? Because he doesn't need to? I don't think so. The great divine Lightfoot, as quoted by the pulpit commentator, says that these shut doors symbolize the fact that God was never to leave his temple again. He's going to be shut in the temple, perhaps. But again, you have a symbol that sort of restrains God's omniscience, or rather I should say his omnipotence. He can't go through the gate. I don't like that one either. Here's what John Gill says the shut door symbolizes. Option number three. It is an emblem of the Church of Christ on earth in the latter day. The way into that is designed here. And its being shut signifies that, as the church is a garden enclosed, a spring shut up, and is only for the use of Christ, and should be a chaste virgin to him, he should have all her heart, affection, and faith. so it should not be pervious unto others. No natural or unregenerate man should enter into it. Now this makes sense. As we read on in the chapter, we'll see God complaining about all the unclean people who had been in the temple. And so that makes a lot of sense. The door is shut to keep the bad guys out of the Church of Christ. I love that word pervious. The church is not pervious. It's not penetrable by bad guys. Here's option number four as to why the gate remains shut. It remains shut as a mark of respect to Yahweh. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says this, as a mark of respect to an Eastern monarch, the gate by which he enters is thenceforth shut to all other persons. Now that makes sense too. Benson backs that up. He says this order was given, the order to keep the gate shut, both to perpetuate the remembrance of the solemn entrance of the glory of the Lord into the house, and also to possess the minds of the people with a deep reverence for the divine majesty and with very awful thoughts of his transcendent glory. So those last two options, I think, make sense, and they're not mutually exclusive. One is that no unholy person is to enter the church, so the gates are shut. And the other reason is we shut the gates because the king's gone through the gates, and that's it. No common person is going to go through the gates anymore, so we show respect to God. Now, the public commentary points out that in the tabernacle in the wilderness and in Solomon's first temple, the doors are always open. They weren't shut. So this is a difference in Ezekiel's new covenant temple. I think the end of verse 2 helps explain this shutting. The end of verse 2 says it is to remain shut because the Lord, the God of Israel, has entered through it. And that sounds like the option 4, that this shutting is a mark of respect to Yahweh. The end of verse 2 says, it's because Yahweh has entered through it that we're going to keep it shut. And that sounds a lot like we're trying to make this a special occasion to mark our respect for Yahweh. We go now to verse 3 of Ezekiel 44. The prince himself is the only one who may sit inside the gateway to eat in the presence of the Lord. He is to enter by way of the portico of the gateway and go out the same way. The gateway that we're talking here and its porch, I'm assuming, is the gate between the inner and outer court. Now, who is this prince? He's mentioned here for the first time. I'm going to give you three options. The high priest, option number one. Option number two, the king of Israel or the civil ruler of Israel under the Messiah, representing the Messiah. Or option number three, the Messiah himself. Well, option number one is the high priest. Just like Eli had a special seat in the tabernacle, we read in 1 Samuel 1, 9, Hannah got up after they ate and drank at Shiloh. Eli the priest was sitting on a chair by the doorpost of the Lord's tabernacle. Notice there's eating and drinking. That's probably done in the inner courtyard. Eli the priest is sitting right there on a chair by the doorpost. Option number two, the prince is the king of Israel, or the civil ruler of Israel, if it's Zerubbabel, who wasn't a king. He was merely a governor. And this political figure, of course, would be ruling under the Messiah. Now, such a person might have a place in the temple peculiar to himself. The Jews actually say that only the kings of the house of David were allowed to sit in the sanctuary. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that option number three is no good. The prince can't be the Messiah himself because the Messiah will never offer a burnt offering for himself, as he does in Ezekiel 46:4, which reads, "The burnt offering that the prince presents to the Lord on the Sabbath day is to be 6 unblemished lambs and an unblemished ram." So why would the Messiah be offering an offering, a sacrifice, a sin offering? Because he doesn't sin. So I think Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's point is well taken. So that tends to make us think that this prince is a political leader, not the Messiah. Bidson agrees with that. He says that the kings of Judah had a distinguished place in the temple, a kind of tribunal placed opposite the eastern gate. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Barnes says the rabbis choose option number three, that the prince is the Messiah. But as I said, Messiahs, especially Jesus the Messiah, Messiahs don't offer sacrifices for themselves. Now, verse 3, we see the prince himself is the only one who may sit inside the gateway to eat. Benson says of that, the gate should in general be shut for, or shut to the prince, as well as to private persons. Even he should not have the liberty of entering in at the gate, except at certain seasons. So Benson says this is how you get around the problem of the fact that the gate's shut. How does the prince get through the gate if it's shut? Because he only comes in at exceptional times. Now this prince sits when he eats, Poole says that perhaps the high priest might have some privilege to sit when others might not. Poole likes option number one, the prince being the high priest. I am going to take option number two, that this prince is a civil leader of Israel, either the king or Zerubbabel. Now, why is the prince eating in the inner courtyard? Well, priest eating with the people is a sign of fellowship. This is very common imagery, for example, from the peace offering. The fellowship offering, as some translations have it, where priest ate parts of the sacrifice with the offerors of the sacrifice. The people and the priests get together in happy fellowship. So here we have the king eating in happy fellowship with the saints. Now John Gill, who apparently thinks the prince is the Messiah, he says this: may this eating not be understood consistent with the scope of the vision of his sitting in his church at his table there with his saints, eating with them and they with him in his word and ordinances before the Lord. But again, I would ask John Gill, how can the prince, if he's the Messiah, be offering a sacrifice for himself in Ezekiel 46? I don't think so. Now, this eating, of course, would not just be eating an ordinary Now, this eating, of course, would not just be eating an ordinary meal, but it would include participation in the animals which were sacrificed, just like in a peace offering. Now, in verse 3, this prince is to enter by the way of the portico of the gateway and go out the same way. The portico is the porch structure, that high structure that goes over the entranceway to the gate. Now, some have said that this is a type of Christ's ascension to heaven and descent from heaven. I think that's pretty much of a stretch. I think that's typology gone mad. Some people have said this is Jesus going in and out of his church at his will and pleasure. Again, you have to take the prince as the Messiah, and I have trouble with that. We go down to Ezekiel 44, verses 4 through 5. Then the man brought me, that man, of course, is the man shining like bronze, who is Jesus, the man with the measuring line in his hand. Then the man brought me by the way of the north gate to the front of the temple. I looked and saw the glory of the Lord filling the temple of the Lord, and I fell face down. The Lord said to me, Son of man, look carefully, listen closely, and give attention to everything I tell you concerning all the regulations regarding the temple of the Lord. Give attention to the entrance of the temple and all the exits of the sanctuary. Now, this giving attention means you got to be careful, because holiness, you have to be very precise when you want to be holy. There is no margin for error. Read the book of Leviticus, and you'll see that in a great big hurry. The idea is the same here. We want to be holy. We want to pay attention to every detail, that we want to please the Lord in every particular. Now, this man has taken Ezekiel to the north gate. Now, that's probably the north gate of the inner court. We're assuming that the gate from the inner court to the outer court, the eastern gate, was shut, as we just said. And so now Jesus walks Ezekiel in the vision over to the north gate. Then Ezekiel, from that vantage point, saw the glory of God filling the temple. Now, that process had started in the last chapter, Ezekiel 43:5. Then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the inner court, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. I don't think it happened twice. I think that Hebrew verbs are hard to tie down as far as tense is concerned, since they don't really have any tense. It's based more on context. So I'm assuming that the glory of the Lord has been filling up the temple while Ezekiel's been talking to Jesus, and now Ezekiel gets a good look at it and falls on his face. That's a normal reaction when you see the glory of God. So in verse 5, God says, listen carefully, get close attention, just as I said. And in particular, Jesus tells Ezekiel, give attention to the entrance of the temple and the exits of the sanctuary. Well, I'm going to assume that the entrance and the exits are the same thing. I don't think you could say that, like in a theater, you know, you go in the front and the exits are at the bottom. So let's just say the doorways. Why? As John Gill says, because it was in these things God's professing people chiefly offended, as appears by what follows. They were not so careful as they should have been in the admission of persons among them or in the exclusion of delinquents. So that's why they're supposed to pay careful attention. Who are you going to let into this temple? Ezekiel, tell the people, you just can't let any old person into God's presence. We go now to Ezekiel 44, verses 6 through 9. Yahweh continues speaking to Ezekiel. Say to the rebellious house of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Enough of your detestable practices, O house of Israel. In addition to all your other detestable practices, you brought foreigners uncircumcised in heart and flesh into my sanctuary, desecrating my temple while you offered me food, fat, and blood, and you broke my covenant. Instead of carrying out your duty in regard to my holy things, you put others in charge of my sanctuary. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. No foreigner uncircumcised in heart and flesh is to enter my sanctuary, not even the foreigners who live among the Israelites. Now, who are these foreigners? They are typically representative of unregenerate people in the Church of Christ, as John Gill says, especially the leaders, because verse 8 refers to those who are in charge. Verse 8 says, you put others in charge of my sanctuary. Here's what John Gill says concerning these unregenerate people who are in the temple. Unfit to be received as swine into a king's palace. Saints and they cannot talk together, their language being different. They are barbarians to one another, nor can they walk together, being not agreed in sentiment and practice. Besides, such persons disquiet the churches of Christ by their quarrelsome behavior in it, and immoral conversation out of it, and are dangerous and infectious persons, whether heterodox in principle or immoral in life. The church seems to attract tares, and there are all kinds of disgusting people who claim to be Christians, and they worm their way into churches. We need to guard the entrances and the exits of the New Testament temple, folks. Church discipline, excommunication if necessary. Now, one might ask, is the man shining like bronze, is he making an historical reference? Is he making an historical reference to the practices of Israel? The NIV commentary, I'm not sure exactly what that was, and I forgot where I got this, but it's a commentary that's labeled NIV, says this: the Israelites had utilized foreigners in temple service under Joshua and David, and this was common among ancient religions of the Near East. Now, these foreigners had started out as water carriers and servants to the Levites, and it seems that they had gradually been allowed to assume some of the priestly duties. But, of course, I think the ultimate reference is to the antitype bad guys entering into the new covenant temple, the Church of Jesus Christ. We go now to Ezekiel 44, verses 10 through 14. The Levites, and let me stop right here. What Ezekiel means by the Levites, he means the priests. Remember, the priests were of the tribe of Aaron, of the family of Aaron, and Aaron was of the tribe of Levi. So the priests were Levites, and the Levites were Levites. It's confusing, but this is talking about the priest here. The Levites who went far from me when Israel went astray and who wandered from me after their idols must bear the consequences of their sin. They may serve in my sanctuary, having charge of the gates of the temple and serving in it. They may slaughter the burnt offerings and sacrifices for the people and stand before the people and serve them. But because they served them in the presence of their idols and made the house of Israel fall into sin, therefore I have sworn with uplifted hand that they must bear the consequences of their sin, declares the Sovereign Lord. They are not to come near to serve me as priests, to come near any of my holy things or my most holy offerings. They must bear the shame of their detestable practices. Yet I will put them in charge of the duties of the temple and all the work that is to be done in it. Now, we see here a demotion of the bad priest who encouraged the people in idolatry. The bad priests are demoted to do what is normally done by the Levites, who were not priests, the ordinary Levites. Those Levites were doorkeepers, guards, temple police. They slew sacrifices. They didn't actually offer them, but they prepared them for sacrifice. And so God is saying these priests who encouraged the people in idolatry, he's not going to completely execute them or anything or exile them. He's going to let them keep serving in the temple, but in a diminished capacity. Now, in verse 10, these priests are said to have gone far from God. Well, when did that happen? Well, here's some options that have been suggested. The Israelites joining themselves to Baal Peor in the fields of Moab right before they went into the Promised Land, right before Moses died. Famous story. Or it could be the defection of the priest in the times of Jeroboam and Rehoboam when the kingdom split in 931 after Solomon died, when all Israel forsook the word of the Lord As Adam Clark says, this refers to the schism of Jeroboam, who, when he set up a new worship, got as many of the priests and Levites to join him in his idolatry as he could. These, on the return from the captivity, should not be permitted to perform the functions of priests in the new temple, but they might be continued as keepers of all the charge of the house, treasurers, guards of the temple, porters. The whole of these passages refer to the period of time when the second temple was built. Well, that's Clark's opinion that this is referring to Zerubbabel's temple. I just think that this is referring to the fact that priests unto the Lord, i.e. New Testament Christians, need to be holy. You want to get demoted? You want to keep the doorway? You want to start slicing up animals? Metaphorically speaking, of course. Well, then violate the holiness of God. Desecrate your consecration unto him. You'll get demoted, all right. I'm not saying you're going to lose your salvation, of course, but you will get demoted. Now, in verse 12, these unfaithful priests serve the people in the presence of their idols. Is the "their" referring to the priest idols or the people's idols? Well, I think it's the people's idols. It's what Joseph Benson says. We go to Ezekiel 44, verses 15 through 16. But the priest, who are Levites and descendants of Zadok, and who faithfully carried out the duties of my sanctuary when the Israelites went astray from me, are to come near to minister before me. They are to stand before me to offer sacrifices of fat and blood, declares the Sovereign Lord. They alone are to enter my sanctuary. They alone are to come near my table to minister before me and perform my service. So here are the true priests, those who were not unfaithful to Yahweh, and again, carrying out the typology that would be Christians now in the New Covenant Temple of God, faithfully carrying out their service to Yahweh. Now, why are these faithful priests called descendants or sons of Zadok? Zadok was descended from Eleazar, the son of Aaron. Aaron had four sons, Nadab and Abihu, who got killed because of their offering strange fire. They violated the Levitical ritual. They got burnt up by Yahweh, and that left Ithamar and Eleazar. And you can trace the lines of the priest down, the line of Ithamar. The high priest went all the way down to Phinehas, the son of Eli. But now Zadok was a son not of Ithamar, but of Eleazar. Eleazar's line got put into the priesthood by Solomon. We read in 1 Kings 2:35, then the king, that's Solomon, appointed Benaiah in Joab's place over the army, and he appointed Zadok the priest in Abiathar's place, or Abiathar's place, or however you want to pronounce his name, place. Abiathar, Abiathar. So you got these two competing lines of priests descended from Aaron's son, one in the line of Eleazar and one in the line of Ithamar. Well, it turns out that Zadok, who is in the line of Eleazar, was faithful to David during Absalom's rebellion, but Abiathar, who is from Ithamar's lineage, he went with Absalom in Absalom's rebellion. And so that's how Zadok ended up being a faithful priest in the kingdom of Christ, or in the kingdom of Israel. Let me read you from Ellicott. They, that means the sons of Zadok, are here described as those who continued faithful in the general apostasy. And it is probable that Ezekiel uses the term in this sense, as Zadok had continued faithful in the rebellion of Adonijah, when even the high priest and lifelong friend of David went astray, so all the faithful priests in the time of apostasy were called sons of Zadok. We read a little bit about Absalom's conspiracy in 1 Kings 1, verses 7 through 8. He, that's referring to Absalom, conspired with Joab, son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest. They supported Adonijah. But Zadok the priest did not side with Adonijah. This is referring to the rebellion that happened as David was dying and the kingdom was supposed to be passed down to Solomon. Solomon ended up with the kingdom, but there was a little civil disturbance before that happened, and Zadok stayed faithful to David during that time, and so that's why if you're a son of Zadok, you're a faithful priest. So, getting away from the weeds a little bit, it's clear here that Ezekiel is trying to separate unfaithful ministers to the Lord from faithful ministers to the Lord. If you're into sermons, that might be a good application for a sermon. We go now to Ezekiel 44, verses 17 through 19. When they enter the gates of the inner court, that's talking about the sons of Zadok, the faithful priest, They are to wear linen clothes. They must not wear any woolen garment while ministering at the gates of the inner court or inside the temple. They are to wear linen turbans on their heads and linen undergarments around their waist. They must not wear anything that makes them perspire. When they go out into the outer court where the people are, they are to take off the clothes they have been ministering in and are to leave them in the sacred rooms and put on other clothes so that they do not consecrate the people by means of their garments. So why are the faithful priests, the sons of Zadok, to wear linen? Because linen is fine linen, clean and white, which is the righteousness of the saints. Now John Gill, who is very familiar with Jewish rabbis, say that the rabbis said that the priest under the law, under the Mosaic law, they had wool upon them in the time of their ministry because the purple, blue, and scarlet were all of them dyed wool. Now, I don't think that's in Leviticus. I couldn't find it. I think he's just quoting the rabbis there. But Gill says that the girdle of the high priest, the ephod of the high priest, the breastplate, and other things were made out of wool. That's for the normal priest, the average priest. But the high priest, he exclusively wore linen on the Day of Atonement. And Gill makes the point here that if this is so, in Ezekiel's New Covenant temple, the priest, i.e. you and me, the Christians, we are even better priests than in the Old Testament. Because in the Old Testament, the priest could wear wool. But now we don't. As New Covenant priests, we only wear linen. Now why in the New Covenant temple were the priests not to wear wool? Because wool is inferior to linen. It produces sweat. It smells really bad when sweat gets on it. Wool is liable to contract moth and worms. It's very easy to get dirty. So no wool. In fact, in verse 18, Ezekiel says, these sons of Zadok, the priests, must not wear anything that makes them perspire, because sweat is not clean, pure, and holy. Now, after they finish ministering, offering the sacrifices and so forth, they're supposed to take off their linen clothes and leave them in the sacred rooms. Now, that could just be the temple side chambers that were mentioned earlier in our description of the temple. But remember, the priest had northern and southern chambers, two rows of three-story rooms with a walkway in the middle, and two rooms at the end of the outermost three-story building, containing the baking and boiling room, and another room where they washed the burnt offerings. Well, those two rooms didn't store the linen garments, but somewhere in these priest chambers, there could have been a room that stored the priest garments. That makes sense, since the priests are going to be living there. It makes more sense to me than to say that they put the linen garments in the side chambers of the temple along the temple wall. We read about these sacred rooms in Ezekiel 42, verse 13. Then the man, that's the same man of bronze, Jesus, said to me, "The northern and southern chambers that face the temple yard are the holy chambers where the priests who approach the Lord will eat the most holy offerings. There they will deposit the most holy offerings, the grain offerings, sin offerings, and restitution offerings, for the place is holy." So these priest chambers were not only places for the priests to live, but they obviously had storerooms there for grain and animals for offerings. Likewise, they would be a place to keep the linen garments. We go now to Ezekiel 44, verses 20 through 23. They, referring to the sons of Zadok, the good, faithful priest, they must not shave their heads or let their hair grow long, but they are to keep the hair of their heads trimmed. No priest is to drink wine when he enters the inner court. They must not marry widows or divorced women. They may marry only virgins of Israelite descent or widows of priests. They are to teach my people the difference between the holy and the common and show them how to distinguish between the unclean and the clean. Now that last verse 23 is a perfect description of the book of Leviticus, is it not? What's holy, what's not holy? What's dirty and what's clean? Ritually speaking, of course. Now verse 20, these priests, sons of Zadok, are not to shave their heads. Pagan priests did that. As John Gill says, the priests and worshippers of Isis and Serapis did that. And Adam Clark says, the priests of Isis shaved their heads close to the skin. The priest of Budu do so. I think by Budu he meant Buddha. And I thought about that after I read Clark. And I thought back to my 23 years in China. And I saw lots of Buddhist priests. And I don't believe I saw one hair on any of their heads. They're still shaving their heads. So the Jewish priest are not to do that to distinguish them from the pagan priest. They're supposed to keep their head trimmed. If they trim their hair too short, they would look like pagan priests if they were bald. But if they let their hair grow too long, they would look like Nazarites or women or luxurious people who like long hair to show off how rich they were, or maybe barbarians who didn't cut their hair, or maybe soldiers in warfare. Hard to cut your hair when you're out fighting. But at any rate, they're supposed to keep their heads trimmed. They're not supposed to look like barbarians like certain modern Americans that I know. It wasn't as bad as when I was in college in the 1960s when the hippie revolution hit. Now I know somebody's going to say, well, what about Jesus? He had long hair. Well, I guess he did. If you got a beard so you can see that you're not a woman, I guess long hair is perfectly okay. But at any rate, the priest was supposed to keep his head trimmed. He was not supposed to drink wine. Now, John Gill says that means he's not supposed to drink wine to excess, but I don't think so. I think it means he's not supposed to drink wine at all, as some commentators said, so that the quote-unquote holy enthusiasm of their service will not be mistaken for inebriation. In other words, a priest might have a hallelujah breakdown, might start speaking in tongues or shaking or something, and people would think, that's not the spirit, that's wine, like in the days of Pentecost when they were not drunk as ye suppose at 9 o'clock in the morning. At any rate, the priest is not supposed to drink wine, not a hint of inebriation. The priest must not marry widows or divorced women. Why was that? Well, when a woman was given a certificate of divorce, and I assume the priest would be given one too, there might have been some wrongdoing involved with that. We are hereby divorcing you because your wife was running around on somebody. Well, that doesn't look good for a priest. Now let's compare the marriage law for priests in Leviticus and in Ezekiel. I'm going to split out the laws for the high priest and the ordinary priest because the laws were different. Let's start with the high priest first. In Leviticus, a high priest could not marry a widow, a divorced woman, and of course not a prostitute. That's for the high priest. Now in Ezekiel, no prohibitions are mentioned because the high priest is not mentioned, just rules for the ordinary priest. Now let's go to the ordinary priest. In Leviticus 21:7, we see that the ordinary priest could marry a divorced woman or a prostitute, but they could marry a widow. In Ezekiel, an ordinary priest cannot marry a widow, a divorced woman, or a prostitute. So the prohibition against marrying widows for ordinary priests in Ezekiel is where Ezekiel's law heightens the Levitical law. So one more example of how this New Covenant temple is different than the Old Testament temples. Now there is an exception to the requirement that a priest cannot marry a widow. An ordinary priest in Ezekiel's New Covenant temple could marry a widow in a certain circumstance if she were a particular type of widow, namely the widow of another priest. Why is that? One commentator suggests it's because a widow of a priest marrying another priest would be so used to religious exercises that she could adapt to it much quickly. She could adapt to it very quickly. She could adapt to the manner of living of the second husband, who was also a priest. We go now to Ezekiel 44, verses 24 through 27. The man who looked like bronze, who is Jesus, says, "In any dispute, the priests are to serve as judges and decide it according to my ordinances. They are to keep my laws and my decrees for all my appointed feasts, and they are to keep my Sabbaths holy. A priest must not defile himself by going near a dead person. However, if the dead person was his father or mother, son or daughter, brother or unmarried sister, then he may defile himself. After he is cleansed, he must wait 7 days. On the day he goes into the inner court of the sanctuary to minister in the sanctuary, he is to offer a sin offering for himself, declares the Sovereign Lord." Now, the law against defiling oneself, if you're a priest, by going near a dead person is the same as it is in Leviticus. Leviticus 21:1-2, the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to Aaron's sons, the priest, and tell them, a priest is not to make himself ceremonially unclean for a dead person among his relatives, except for his immediate family, his mother, father, son, daughter, or brother." So an ordinary priest in the law of Moses could take care of his family members. If one of them died, he could become unclean, not a problem, but a high priest couldn't even do that. Leviticus 21:11, he, the high priest, must not go near any dead person or make himself unclean, even for his father or mother. Well, the high priest rules are not mentioned in Ezekiel, The rules for the ordinary priest are mentioned, and they're the same as in the Mosaic Law. Now, here's a distinction in the Mosaic Law in verse 26. After the priest is cleansed, when he comes in contact with a dead person, he must wait 7 days. Now, that's different than the old Levitical Law. In the old Levitical Law, it took 7 days to get clean from the defilement. In other words, from the day that the priest touches the dead person, it took him 7 days to get clean, and after 7 days he was clean. But here in Ezekiel, it's after he is cleansed he must wait 7 days. So he touches the dead person, 7 days goes by, and then he's got to wait 7 more days. And this is one more indication that this temple is meant for post-Mosaic times. In other words, this is the New Covenant temple that's being typified here. We go now to Ezekiel 44, verses 28 through 31, and we will finish this chapter. Yahweh continues to speak to Ezekiel, "I am to be the only inheritance the priests have. You are to give them no possession in Israel. I will be their possession. They will eat the grain offerings, the sin offerings, and the guilt offerings, and everything in Israel devoted to the Lord will belong to them. The best of all the first fruits and of all your special gifts will belong to the priest. You are to give them the first portion of your ground meal so that a blessing may rest on your household. The priest must not eat anything, bird or animal found dead or torn by wild animals." Now, all of this is the same as in the Levitical Law. For example, we see in Numbers 18, verse 20, that the priests were not to have any land. Their only inheritance was to be God. In other words, God's going to take care of them. Numbers 18, 20, "Then the Lord said to Aaron, 'You shall have no inheritance in their land, nor own any portion among them.'" Aaron, of course, stands for the priesthood. "I, says Yahweh, am your portion and your inheritance among the sons of Israel." Nothing changed there. And also, we see in Leviticus 2:3, "And the remainder of the grain offering belongs to Aaron and his sons, a thing most holy of the offerings of the Lord by fire." So the priests got grain offerings in Ezekiel's temple and also in Moses' tabernacle. Now in verse 31, Ezekiel's priest must not eat anything found dead or torn by wild animals. That's exactly the same law that applied to all Israelites, not just the priest, in the Levitical Law. Leviticus 17:15, "And when any person eats an animal which dies or is torn by beast, whether he is a native or an alien, he shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and remain unclean until evening. Then he will become clean." And ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Ezekiel chapter 44. We're now prepared to go to Ezekiel chapter 45. I will entitle Ezekiel 45, "The Holy District and the Portion for the Prince." I hope you join with me in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.